Recording 1, 2, 3. This is an interview for the Brickmakers Oral History Project. This is Andrea Lamdia, and today I'm interviewing Norm Davis at Moran Brick Company, and it's in Auburn. Is that correct?
Right.
In Auburn, Maine. The date is June 28, 2007. Could you start just by giving me your full name?
Norman Davis.
And when were you born?
1945.
In Auburn?
Waterville.
Did you grow up in Waterville?
No, I grew up around Lewiston, well, in Auburn, South
okay.
Auburn.
So what was Auburn like when you were growing up, in terms of what it's like today?
I think I've seen a lot of change. The mills and shoe shops are gone. I know they used to talk about rush hour in Lewiston. It was when Lewiston and Auburn. It's when the mills let out at 3 o'clock, followed by the shoe shops at 4 o'clock, and traffic was tied up quite a bit. If you went out Center Street, if you got much beyond where Quiznos is today, was more rural. John White's dairy cows were right where the Auburn Mall is, so that's all changed. The high school, when I was a kid, the high school at Edward Little up on the hill didn't exist. Though I did go there the last 2 years of high school. They built it while I was young.
Yeah.
A lot of dirt roads. There's very few in Auburn now. Changed. I think the whole landscape has changed. I can remember taking a train from Auburn to go up to Aroostook County where we had relatives, riding up on the train. That's gone. And I'm younger than most of the old brickmakers, but you know, I think the whole downtown area has totally changed.
Yeah.
And pretty much for the better. People have moved out of the city, if you will, and moved out into the outskirts a little more. Seen a lot of growth in housing, residential areas. A lot of the bedroom communities, Minot, Poland, Turner, seem to have grown. And a lot of people are commuting into town that didn't used to. New industry, that's the good thing, is, you know, we're more diversified than we were.
Mm-hmm. And what did your parents do for work when you were growing up?
I was raised by an aunt and uncle. Uncle worked in a brick plant.
Yeah.
Aunt worked in a shoe factory.
Now, was your uncle's involvement with the brick company, was that what got you interested or gave you a way in?
It didn't necessarily give me a way in. It started as a job after school in, you know, summers and things. Never had any intent of doing it for a career.
Mm-hmm.
One thing led to another. Mr. Moran was good to me, helped me finish school, and I just felt I owed him something for using me so well while I was in school, and the rest is history.
So what did you do when you first started, when you were in school?
Sanding brick, picking up broken brick, unloading freight cars that came in, worked on the kiln somewhat, firing them with wood.
Mm-hmm.
Did quite a bit of that. That's about it.
Can you talk about how the Moran Brick Company has grown and changed over the years?
I've seen it go from molding brick on the ground, drying them in the sun, firing the kilns with wood. Had a season of approximately 100 days a year molding brick. Then it would last for another month or two in the fall while they fired the last of the brick. And then pretty much shut down through the winter, did very little shipping. That's all changed. They went from that to unmolding brick on wooden pallets and drying them in sheds outdoors, everything air dried. Moving things around with forklifts instead of wheelbarrows. Then it went from that to, instead of loading brick on dump trucks, to taking them to a job and either unloading them by hand or dumping them in a big pile, to a packaging system where the brick could be handled with equipment on the truck and forklifts on the job site. In the late 70s, well, in the early 70s, we purchased a plant in Gorham, so it gave us double the capacity. Then in the late 70s, we converted this plant to an automated kiln that just ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and gave us year-round production, so that we increased our production somewhat. Well, it actually doubled the production. It eliminated burning wood and all of the interesting things that went with getting enough wood, because we used over 2,000 cords of wood a year. And with the increased production, we'd have been using 12,000 to 15,000 cords of wood a year and over 1 million gallons of oil. So we got a lot of energy efficiencies with the new system. And then all through the 80s and 90s, we continued to, as much as we could, apply the latest technology that was available. Finally, in about 4 years ago, we determined that it really wasn't feasible to any longer run two plants here and Gorham. So we brought Gorham's production here, so we increased our capacity once again. And it was now large enough that we could put in still more machinery, automate things very well, so that we no longer set brick by hand. It's done, other than special runs, pretty much we do it with robotics. We lengthen out our kiln. We get more energy efficiency out of it. We now use approximately 35% of the BTUs to make a brick that we would have used 30 years ago. Uh-huh. So, and that was the big thing. Energy is so expensive.
I have a question. A couple people I've talked to have said it was using the wood to fire the bricks that gave it its color. What happens when you go to oil? Or how does that...
Oil, and then, well, about 7 or 8 years ago, we put natural gas in as well. No, everybody thought it was the wood that made the color of the brick. No, the coloring is a natural thing within the clays. As they're fired, we're actually oxidizing the clay or rusting the clay, and that's what turns it red.
Okay.
To get the darker blacks around the edges, it has to go through and become more of a scientific thing. I would have believed it was wood smoke years ago as well. But as we studied it, we worked with Clemson University, one of the leading ceramic schools in the world. And I did a lot of work with Clemson, went down to Clemson. It's actually the clay oxidizing or rusting, if you will. We do what nature would take thousands of years to do in a matter of days, which will turn it red. And then when it reaches the maturing temperature, the peak temperature we want, we let smoke go through the kiln. It used to be wood that went through the kiln. We now use natural gas. And we, the smoke starves the atmosphere for oxygen. And when that happens, the brick won't re-oxidize or turn back to a copper color. It'll stay red and black. So basically, you're just choking the air out of the atmosphere. Years ago, all of this smoke would have just gone off in the atmosphere off the top of the kiln, with the old kilns, wood-fired kilns. We now can redirect that smoke down through the firing zone of our kiln, burn it off, so we have almost no visible emissions. And as it burns off, we're getting the benefits of the BTUs left in the smoke. So that's one of the biggest ways that we reduced our energy consumption, is better control of our fuel going into the kiln, and redirecting all the smoke and the byproducts of poor combustion, because we have to actually create poor combustion to keep the brick red and black. And rather than just putting it off into the atmosphere and create an environmental problem, we can redirect it, burn it off. And, so, you know, we meet a lot of exceed environmental standards.
Right.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about some of the experiences you've had over the years with brick making. Are there any anecdotes or anything that stand out in your memory?
I think we've had a lot of good people, a lot of dedicated people. Even now, We'll have employees come in an entry-level job, and there's some turnover there, but we've said for years, if you're with us for 2 years, you'll probably be with us for a career. Years ago, when it was a periodic plant, we just ran during the summer with the old plants. There were a lot of, like myself, young people that came in and worked several summers while we were finishing school, high school or college. And it's what put most of us through school. So you met a lot of good people that went on to very successful careers, and that's pretty satisfying. Other than those people, it's not uncommon to have people that have worked for us 30 and 40 years. We had a man, in fact, the uncle that I grew up with, retired a few years ago because of health. His greatest disappointment was he had only a few more months to go to make 60 years with the company.
Wow.
We had another man that started with the company around 1915, 16, with horses and everything. And he worked right up until he was 84, I think, 83 or 84 years old. Now, he wasn't out, you know, whatever, but he was very, very active, very healthy. Currently, we have people that have been with the company that I worked with when we were in school. We have a lot of people 15, 20, 25, 30 years. And that happens where young people are trying to find themselves and what do I want to do for a career. Happens in every industry, and they move around. If they finally find where they want, they lock in. But, you know, we're pretty pleased that we have such longevity with a lot of our people. Some of the other, I think, satisfying things are some of the projects we've done. Started back in the 1930s, and it continues to even this year. We'll have a project at Colby College, and we furnished every building at Colby College. Bates College, we've done all of their work for many, 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 many years. We have two projects underway right now as we speak at Bates. We've done most of Bowdoin's work for the last 25, 30 years. We do a tremendous amount of work at Harvard University. Boston, the whole downtown waterfront Boston area, we've done any number of buildings down there and continue to do the a lot of buildings in the Boston area. We've, some of the other good things, bought out another brick company that had manufactured brick the old way and stopped manufacturing and was one of our customers that resold the brick in the Bangor area. We bought them out a few years ago, so that gave us Gorham, Auburn, and Bangor, so we could pretty well cover the state. We also have distribution in Canada, which was another new market for us, and we've done that within the last 10 or 12 years. And with other distributors we have, we pretty much cover the whole Northeast. From Halifax to Western Pennsylvania.
So. Wow. Are there some that aren't with us anymore that I wouldn't have a chance to interview that worked for the company that you could describe them? In terms of, you know, when they did it the old way?
The one I spoke of that started way back around 1915 or 16, when he was mid-70s, I guess, or something. I said to him one day, Randall, you know, if you want, you can be our water boy. And what the water boy did is just wet the clay down in the brick machine and temper it so that it would have the right consistency. He made brick then for over 60 years, been around a brick plant, was, you know, could do any task that you gave him. And he said, I don't want that job, that's an old man's job. He was around 80 years old, and he walked in one day in the early spring and said, start the machine up. I guess I'm old enough to do the water boy job. So I said, well, fine. When we start it up, if you want it, it's yours. He ended up being one of the worst people we could have ever put on the machine, only because you go up and he said, this is a boring job. I got to find something to do. And he was always off doing something else and not paying attention to the clay. He would be off fixing pallets. He, you know, he was just still in his 80s and still very active and moving and didn't want to do an old man's job, you know. But it was funny because a lot of years had gone by from the time I said, if you want to be the, do this, job, you can do it. And he wanted to wait until he got old. But I don't know that he ever got old, because he never did like the job, because it was an old man's job, even in his 80s.
I understand that when they had the small brick places making the bricks, that they pretty much had to keep moving all the time from one step to the next. And that I'm thinking that's probably how he...
Yeah, you did. I mean, everybody learned as many different tasks as they could. It made them a little more valuable, and let them, if they could do other things once the molding stopped, when we got frost in the fall, it gave them a chance to stay on another 2 or 3 months while they burned the last of the brick. If they couldn't do that, then there was nothing for them.
Right.
A lot of these people went off into the woods working, cutting wood for the next year, too. not with all companies, but with this particular one, they opened a sawmill in the 1940s, so that not only would they go into the woods and cut wood for the brick plant, but they cut a lot of logs, saw logs and things like that, so they ran a sawmill as well. So a lot of them worked in the woods through the winter months.
Yeah.
Be busy.
Now, I noticed a lot of people's jobs were described as strikers.
Strikers, and that was probably physically the most demanding job. And what that was is the people that actually molded the brick. It was demanding because of the way the machine was built. There was a lot of, it was just hard on your body physically. You had to jump on a foot press that pressed the clay down into the mold. And then you loaded up molds, and then you ran down the length of a yard where they unmolded them. And then you'd unmold them and run back and do it over and over again. Strikers come from the thing that they did when they molded the brick, is they struck off the top of the mold or wiped off the top of the mold with a stick to size the brick and clean it up. It was hard on your back because there was a lot of bending. There was a lot of lifting. A mold full of brick is going to weigh more today because we use heavier molds, but when they use the pine molds, you're going to weigh 45, 50 pounds. And you're bending over and molding it on the ground down by your feet. So there was a lot of that, and it was difficult.
Now, is that term still used in brick making at your plant today, or not really?
Not really, because it's all done with machines.
Yeah. And I know they have different terms like water struck and wire struck.
Wire cut.
Wire cut.
Yeah. And wire cut is pretty much out the window now. That's water struck is what most of these older timers did. And that term refers to the mold was lubricated with water. They dipped it in a water box and got it wet so that the clay wouldn't adhere to the wooden mold itself. And struck was when they'd strike, and that's where they got the striker. They were strikers, but when they struck or wiped off the top of the mold with a wooden stick, they just pull it towards them to get all the excess mud off the top of the mold, and it kept the brick to the size that the mold was.
Mm-hmm.
About like if you wanted a cup of sugar, you'd round it up and just wipe it off the top so it's an even cupful. That's what striking is.
Yeah.
So you've probably struck a lot of times. Sugar, not mud. what they call the wire cut, today they call extruded, and the process is similar, though it's all automated. Clay is made mixed much harder with a lot less water in it, and it's extruded out through a die in the machine. It's a big machine forcing the clay through a die, about like squeezing toothpaste out of a tube.
Yeah.
And it just comes out in one long continuous column, about like Velveeta cheese. And instead of using a cheese slicer with a wire on it, or you've probably had one of those, basically it's the same thing. They just had a wire come down through that column, or the block of Velveeta cheese, down through the column and slice it into individual brick.
And are those type of bricks used for a different sort of thing than...
No, they're not. They can be used interchangeably on most projects.
Mm-hmm.
It's the water struck are a little more irregular. they looked more like hand-molded, handmade brick,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they actually were. We can continue to replicate that and produce the same brick. We just don't turn the molds over by hand, or we don't unmold them by hand. There's just machinery that handles wooden molds.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of moisture in those kind of brick, a lot of water, as the brick dry out and shrink, they don't have the uniformity. They shrink at different, a little bit different lengths. They still have to be within certain limits, but a few more irregularities, looking more like what they would have made years ago. The extruded brick are a more mechanically perfect brick because there's less than half the moisture in the brick that there was where the water struck. We can control the shrinkage better.
Mm.
We can control the textures better. With a molded brick, you've got one texture, that's it, with the, you know, the surface of the brick. With the extruded, you can run wires on it, you can roll different things onto the face, you can spray on gopes on it to make it look like used brick. You can do any number of things
mm-hmm.
with it. Sand coatings. So you can get a little more variety. And it's used in different architectural projects. They'll just look
mm-hmm.
a little different.
Yeah.
So, and it depends what the owner wants his project to look like.
So the people who owned Morin Brick for years, that was it Ron Morin?
No.
No.
It started out, J.B. Morin, John Morin, started it, the company around 1912. He had 8 sons and a daughter. Then when he passed on, the company was passed down to them. Many of them went and did other things.
Mm-hmm.
One of them started Lewiston Lumber Company in Lewiston. Another one had a sawmill in Auburn. Another one worked on the railroad in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Another one had a store, a little grocery store. Three of them primarily stayed here, working here. Then the one daughter in that family married a man that had, I think, 10 brothers or something like that. she had 5 sons and a couple of daughters. So that whole Morin LaChance, the daughter married LaChance, that
uh-huh.
whole Morin LaChance had a lot of boys, a few girls. And they worked around here when they were young. And after World War II, started their own brick plant in Gorham, which is what we went down and bought out in the early 70s, around 1970. I never saw it myself, but they used to tell a story about during World War II, there were 5 brothers in the service. It came out in Ripley's Believe It or Not, supposedly. And though their uncles had gotten married, because there were, you know, their mother had 8 brothers and their father had 10 brothers, that there were 5 boys in the military that had 18 uncles and no aunts, you know, no blood aunts.
Right.
You know? So that's pretty rare.
Yeah.
But it was good for the brick business.
Yeah.
You know? Some higher power knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Other interesting things that's happened along the way, because of the experience I had with some of the older brick making, and still being probably the youngest of all of them that were around. We also made a few brick in Sydney up between Augusta and Waterville
mm-hmm.
in the mid-60s, and I worked up there quite a bit. Because of that, and because we continue to make the old Waterstruck type brick that there's only 2 other plants in the country that do, I was invited by the ladies of Mount Vernon to go down to Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, a few years ago. And what they wanted to do was build a barn and replicate what was there when George Washington was alive. It was a threshing barn, and it was an octagonal barn, 8 sides to it. And it had a lot of brick on it.
Mm.
So what they wanted to do is dig some clay up, there at Mount Vernon and make the brick right there and make them the way George Washington would have made them. So that's fine, but everything they wanted to authenticate, it had to be the way it was. Well, it was a handful of brick. We could have made all those brick in about 4 hours. But they were, you know, with the way we do today, but what they wanted to do was authenticate it, and I can understand that. So they had some people from Colonial Williamsburg come up as well, and they really didn't get too involved with it. They did a little bit. So they asked if I'd be interested in working with it, but I couldn't because it wasn't time, wouldn't permit it. The funniest part of it, and I still think about it, and how much society has changed. I believe if you can do a task, doesn't matter if you're man or woman, you should be able to do it. There are women driving front-end loaders and trailer trucks that do an excellent job. What they wanted to do was use young interns, and they were going to use young ladies as well as young men to make the brick. And that's fine, except they were so strict on all of their authentication, if you will. And I'm not a racist either. Don't have a problem with it at all. What color your skin is, yellow, black, sky blue, pink, that's fine. We're all made equal. Well, George Washington had made brick with primarily his slaves, and it was the men that did it, not the women. So the authentication went right out the window immediately, but that's okay. I mean,
right.
I understand what they wanted to do, and
right.
They wanted to, so that people visiting Mount Vernon could see how brick were made in those days. Anyway, they spent the whole summer. They didn't get enough brick made for the project. So we ended up making the brick here and sending them down to Mount Vernon and mixing their brick with it. And it came out very, very well. It was a little difficult on our side to try to make something that was made down there, but we made it. But my first visit down there, they wanted, you know, I said that if they had no idea what size to mold the brick at because of the shrinkage and everything. So I said, well, I'll gladly take some of your material back and experiment with it and see what the shrinkages are so we can figure out how big to make the molds. And it was just before 9-1-1, about a year and a half before 9-1-1. So I took a plastic pail and we put about a half a pail full of clay in the pail. So I walked back to the airport and went to go on, and I walked up to the ticket counter and, do you have any baggage to check? And I said, I really don't want to take this on the plane because it was just a down and back thing the same day. I said, but I've got this pail of mud that I got to send back. She said, yeah, mud. And I said, it is. I said, but it's important mud. It's George Washington's mud. You know, George and Washington, George and Martha let me take this home. You know, so, yeah, sure, she said. I said, well, x-ray it, open it up if you want to. You know, the cover just snaps. Oh, she opened it up. So then, first thing I knew, everybody behind the ticket counter and half of the people out back were laughing about, here comes a guy with a pail of mud.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's a neat story.
Yeah. But it was interesting. And, you know, we've had a lot of fun things like that along the way.
Uh-huh.
Brick industry's been good. It's demanding. A lot of businesses are. But it's been good to me.
Yeah, so you would say that with the more automation, it's not as physically demanding
right.
these days.
Right.
And I saw some pictures with the men wearing just bathing suits
right,
making the brick.
Yeah.
That was in the early
right,
days.
Right, that's all gone.
Yeah. Are there any people that you know still around who did the process at that time that I might be able to interview?
Boy, they're all... There was one that molded brick, not on the open yard, out, you know, on the ground, but did mold them. Well, there are two people. One of them did mold them on the ground.
The one was Henry Barraby.
Henry Barraby.
I interviewed him yesterday.
Okay, he did it on the pallets.
Yeah.
In fact, there's one that made brick with Henry. It's Merrill Givens.
Merrill Givens?
Right, and he made brick with us in Sydney, where we made them on the ground, as well as down here. I hadn't seen him in years. He stopped by to visit. A lot of these old-timers come down to visit.
Yeah.
He stopped down, 3-4 months ago or something. But so he's around the Lewis and Auburn area somewhere. It may be Green or
yeah.
Lisbon, but he's around Merrill Givens. Merrill Givens.
Is it G-I-V?
G-I-V-E-N-S.
Yep. But
those are almost the last two. There were a lot of Jagirs that made brick the old way that aren't around anymore.
There are a few of the Morans still left?
There's no Morans at all in the company.
Oh, yeah.
There's one LeChance left. And then some of their children that don't work with the company. There is John Moran, who I believe is retired. He drove truck years. He lives on the road going up over off Washington Street up towards Martindale,
mm-hmm.
of course. And there is Babe Moran, Ethelbert Moran, who lives on the hotel road in Auburn.
And I have heard that name.
Yeah, he's retired. But and, John hasn't been around. He was around when he was a young man. He hasn't been around probably in a little over 40 years.
Yeah.
He hasn't worked here. Ethelbert's been even longer than that. But
They would remember some of the early days.
Yeah. Well, their fathers would have been the sons of, they were third generation.
Oh,
they were third generation Morans. And,
They're
in their 70s, almost 80.
Yeah.
So.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so the two of them.
Now, were there other competing brickyards in the area? Or maybe not competing, but other ones around?
There were many, many, many of them years ago. We had friends, and her father collected antiques. Was an antique dealer out in West Auburn years ago. He's passed away now. And we were out there for dinner one night, and he showed me this old book. It was an Androscoggin. I don't know if it was a registry, what it was, but we looked in it, and I counted up countless. I mean, we're talking 30, 40 little brickworks. What would happen, none of them made a lot of brick.
Mm-hmm.
But when the mills were built, schools and churches, and there were a lot of brick, a lot of streets. The roads were made with brick. The sidewalks were made with brick around Boston Auburn. And a lot of the sidewalks, if you went back today and took the blacktop off them, there's still brick underneath them. A few of the streets, unless I don't know many of them that have been all dug up. Spring Street was done only just, a few years ago.
Right.
It was brick underneath. So there was a real demand for brick, and none of them made very many brick. They made 500,000, 600,000, maybe 1,000,000 at the most. So there was, it was interesting. I found in it that there was a little brickwork across from CMMC Hospital there, right on the corner of Sabatis and Main Street. There was a little one right there.
Oh, wow.
Down on Bartlett Street, across from the hockey rink, what do they call it now? The Coliseum.
The Coliseum.
Across the street where they parked school buses, that was a brick plant way up until about 1950-51. In fact, Morans ran that, the last of it, somebody else first. Dennis Brick in Auburn, just as you come down out of Auburn on Washington Street, as you come down over the hill just beyond Ness Oil, there's a road off to the right, there's a spring water place in there.
Uh-huh.
There was a little brick plant in there up until, I'll say the mid-70s.
Yeah.
There was a little place there. And there may be, I don't know, the old timers are all gone, but there may be some Dennis's around. The last name was Dennis. There may be some there. One that worked when he was in high school at Dennis was Mike Roy that runs Roy's Hamburgers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the only reason I know that, we went to high school together.
We
weren't friends or anything, but I was in a class with him one time. We had to do a report, and he did a report on making brick.
Oh, wow.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
And the only reason I even remember that, I don't remember another report, I don't remember anything about that class other than I was doing the same thing down here.
So
he might, and I think brother, he did only just one or two summers, or part of a summer maybe. I don't know. I don't know what he did. That's all I know about it, period. 50 cents, you get a cup of coffee.
there were a lot of just very little individual
small ones all over.
Yeah.
They made brick in Farmington. They made brick in Hartford. They made brick in Elliott, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
They made them down in the Biddeford-Saco area, which, brick were made in Cambridge for Harvard University. They were made right near there. The Lowell, Lawrence area, there were a lot of brick made. And way back, in the 1800s, early 1900s, transportation was an issue anyway, so they had to make brick very closely.
Right.
I feel kind of privileged working with some of the old-timers. Randall Proctor, the one I mentioned that wanted the water boy job when he was old, told about taking brick to deliver to down near Portland. There were a lot of brick made in the Portland area. But there was a job down near Portland they were doing from here, so took the horses and wagon. They could only haul 300 brick at a time. Today, we had a truck go out of here yesterday for Canada, had 13,000 brick on it, but they could only haul 300 brick in a wagon. And he left in the morning and went to Portland, stayed overnight somewhere on the way back and got back the next day, so it was a two-day trip to Portland. There were a lot of brick made down around Pineland Hospital down there. And he told about taking, when they got their first truck in the 1930s, taking brick down there to Pineland and did a job that they were furnished, that was furnished from here. But yet there was three little brick works only about 2 miles down the road. Mm-hmm. And we came all the way from Auburn to get down to Pineland. But he could deliver them with a truck. And it's kind of interesting thing how it's changed.
Yeah.
From horses, and horses were gone by the time I was around, but they bought their first tractors in the late 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And to watch, how it's gone. We were still, though we were using tractors, excavating clay, totally different than what you do today, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, they just used to shovel it off the side of the ledge, right?
Well, yeah, what they did is they, whether it was horses or tractors, they dragged harrows over it to break the clay up, scoop it up, and then bring it in a pile, and then they put it into a pit and soaked it. And
mm-hmm.
probably what you saw shoveling was after the clay had soaked and become very soft so that they get all the hard lumps out of it, which if you molded a brick with a lump in it, as the clay dried, the lump doesn't shrink. Everything does around it, so it breaks the brick.
Right.
And that's what you probably saw shoveling was out of that pit into the brick machine.
Mm-hmm. So does this area have really good clay? Is there types of clay that are better than others?
Yeah, it varies. And as far as really good, it's very good for what we do.
Mm-hmm.
If we looked at, and it makes some of the most durable brick in the country, structurally strong, the brick are either water struck or extruded wire cut brick, far exceed all ASTM specs. They're very strong, they're very durable. But to manufacture with it, as opposed to using shale and clay mixture like many plants do further away, and there's no shale available up this way, it's not easy. It's a very difficult clay to work with.
Okay.
So yes, it makes a very good end product. It's terrible to work with, as far as, especially when you see what other plants do.
Yeah. Wow. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you feel is important to talk about in terms of brick makers?
No, I think it's interesting. I mean, I'll run into people quite often that still remember when they did it when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
Back during the 60s, early 70s, there were a lot of people that go to work on government jobs, and we had somebody in here every time you turned around from Department of Defense doing background checks. I don't see much of that now because we don't use as many college kids as we used to, but just out of college and trying to. But there was one that worked for us 10 or 11 years ago, one young fella, and he went away to college, But I've heard from him, I think, 5 different times, and not heard directly, but I've heard from somebody in doing background checks for him, and he's working his way through the pecking order of the government and getting more and more and more secure jobs. And
yeah.
He's getting very well up there now.
Wow.
Though you knew him when he was 18 years old, and haven't seen him since. The government, you know, until he's 50, will always check all the way back. They even go back to school teachers sometimes.
Wow.
They'll check, you know, they'll check your whole history to find
yeah.
out where you were. So, and I work with young people a lot, and that's something I try to impress on. You know, everybody screws up a little bit when they're young, but be very careful because you never know really where your career is going to take you.
Yeah.
And they will do background checks, not know, well, that was just a young, foolish thing I did. Have to keep looking at, you know, these politicians we have, and not that I'd encourage these kids to go off into politics, but look at these politicians we have, and they start doing background, you know, and like him or hate him, George Bush, all they could do was dig up dirt from, you know, when he was in the National Guard, yeah, National
mm-hmm.
Guard, he didn't do this or that, or he got caught for drunk driving when Kennebunk once, or Bill Clinton did this or that,
right.
You know, 40 years ago. Well, okay, yeah, he did it. It was young. It was a stupid young indiscretion. But it still got dug up.
Mm.
Now, if it continues to me, and they did it yesterday, that bothers me. But if it was 40 years ago, it's behind them.
Right.
But, you know, I try to impress that on young people. But, you know, and because I see a lot of these people still getting checked on that
yeah.
we haven't seen in years.
Well, thank you very much for
Good.
Your time.
Okay.
I appreciate
it. Hope it goes well.